Bring this meeting of Fisheries Committee to order. It is about 8:37, and today is February 22nd. And present are Representative Johnson, Representative Wilson, Representative Johansson, myself, Representative Seaton, Representative Ludo is excused today. And at this time, I'd like to remind everybody about their cell phones. And today, we have two things. The first is going to be an overview by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Division on salmon management, escapement, over-escapement, and foregone harvest valuations. And after that, we will continue and end public testimony on HB 134. The sponsor of that is not here today, and so we will take that up for committee consideration on Monday and any possible amendments that time. Is anything come before the committee before we get started?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Johansson.
I'd like to note that the gentleman to my right in the rear has an appropriate tie for the Fish Committee. He has a salmon or a fish tie.
Very good, especially today.
You going to put that in the record?
Is there anything else? Seeing nothing else, we'll get started with the department. And would you come forward? And welcome, Patty. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record? And we appreciate your coming. I think we have a PowerPoint, so some of us are going to move around to the side. But go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. I'd like to say good morning and thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Patty Nelson. I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries. And this morning I will present to you an overview of the Commercial Fisheries Division Salmon Management Program with an emphasis on escapement-based management. I'll give you a second to turn around so you can see our slides. Before I begin, I would like to mention that Jaron Bruce, our Assistant Director from the Division, is also here and will be presenting following me. And also Amy Carroll is in the audience. She's our publication specialist and did a great job helping Jaron and I with these, putting together these presentations. So I'd like to thank her.
Great. And Patty, before you continue, I just want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Holmes.
During this presentation, I will discuss the importance of commercial salmon fisheries in Alaska by providing graphs of annual harvests and ex-vessel values. I'll review the relevant policies of escapement goal management in Alaska and provide some definitions that pertain to this style of management. I'll review our process of escapement goal development and the role of the department and the Alaska Board of Fisheries in commercial salmon management. And finally, I will provide you with our recommendations for the future to improve the management of this resource. Alaska's salmon resource is the basis for one of Alaska's most important industries and supports a traditional subsistence lifestyle in rural portions of the state. Five Pacific salmon species spawn and have directed commercial fisheries in Alaska, and the Division of Commercial Fisheries is charged with managing these fisheries in such a way to ensure conservation of salmon, as well as the economic health of Alaska's fishing communities. This graphic summarizes statewide salmon catches and ex-vessel values of all salmon species combined from 1878 to 2007. Years are found along the horizontal axis. Numbers of fish harvested in millions are along the left vertical axis. And each year's harvest is depicted by the light blue bar. Ex-vessel value is found on the right vertical axis and is depicted by the solid red line. Ex-vessel value refers to the postseason adjusted value received by commercial permit holders. From 1998 through 2007, the average harvest of salmon sold by commercial fishermen in Alaska was almost 173 million fish. Keep in mind that was the average, the recent 10-year average. In 2007, the commercial harvest was just over 212 million fish. The recent 10-year average annual ex-vessel value of the harvest was in excess of $284 million. In 2007, the ex-vessel value of the commercial harvest was around $374 million. The value of the commercial harvest varies with size of the runs, market values, and foreign currency exchange rates. You can see that while the ex-vessel value showed a declining trend in the 1990s, since 2002, ex-vessel values have been increasing. The next five graphs that I'm going to show you are in this same format. However, they will show the harvest and ex-vessel value by individual species. Keep in mind that while the horizontal axis will remain the same, the scales of the vertical axes will change. Pink salmon are the most numerous of the salmon species in the Alaska commercial catch and the most abundant salmon in the Pacific Ocean. Annual statewide commercial harvests have averaged around 112 million pink salmon over the past 10 years, and ex-vessel values have averaged around $50 million. The 2007 commercial harvest of 144 million was the third highest on record. You can see from this graph that pink salmon abundance tends to fluctuate between even and odd years, with odd years being dominant over the last 10 years. I'd like to note that there's a little problem with this graph. It was extended out to 2008, which of course is zero. That's why the red line drops. I'd catch that question right up front, didn't I? Okay. Okay, we're on slide six, the sockeye salmon. They are the second most numerous in the Alaska commercial catch and the third most abundant in the Pacific Ocean. Annual statewide sockeye salmon commercial harvests have averaged around 36 million over the past 10 years, and ex-vessel values have averaged around $157 million. The ex-vessel value in 2007 of around $206 million was the highest ex-vessel value since 1999. Chum salmon are the third most numerous salmon species in the commercial catch and the second most abundant salmon. Annual statewide commercial harvests of chum salmon have averaged around 18 million with an average ex-vessel value of $33 million. Coho salmon are the fourth most numerous species and the fourth most abundant salmon. The recent 10-year average statewide commercial harvest is about 4.5 million fish. You can see from the red line on this graph that the ex-vessel value fluctuates greatly for coho salmon, with a range of $13 to $23 million over the past 10 years. And this fluctuation is based on market conditions, but has averaged close to $20 million over the past 10 years. Chinook salmon are the least abundant and the least numerous in the Alaska commercial harvest. Annual statewide commercial harvests of Chinook salmon have averaged around 560,000 with an average ex-vessel value of $17 million. Because of the magnitude of commercial fisheries for salmon, department biologists collect extensive information and statistics that are used to manage these fisheries. After Alaska became a state, the department implemented an escapement goal-based fisheries management system, which remains in place today. In addition to ensuring adequate escapement levels, the department is charged with determining appropriate levels of escapement that will result in sustained yield. The concept of providing for sustained yield is rooted in Alaska's Constitution, where fish shall be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferences among beneficial uses. As a result, the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game is vested with statute with powers to manage, protect, maintain, improve, and extend the fish resources of the state. To provide for an open public process and to give direction to the department, the Alaska State Legislature created the Alaska Board of Fisheries, which is responsible for developing fishery management plans, allocating resources among users, and promulgating regulations. These regulations are intended to provide for sustained yield of the salmon resources of the state through management plans for salmon fisheries, the mixed stock salmon policy, the sustainable salmon fisheries policy, and the salmon escapement goal policy. The Alaska Board of Fisheries adopted the last two policies into regulation in 2000 and 2001, respectively, to ensure that the state's salmon stocks would be conserved, managed, and developed using the sustained yield principle. The two primary escapement goal types that are defined in the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Policy are biological escapement goal, also known as a BEG, which is the escapement that provides the greatest potential for maximum sustained yield, also known as MSY. A sustainable escapement goal, or SEG, represents a level of escapement indicated by an index or an escapement estimate that is known to provide for sustained yield over a 5 to 10 year period. Sustainable escapement goals are used in situations where a biological escapement goal cannot be estimated. Along these lines, the term over-escapement, which can be defined in various ways but is defined by the department as escapements that are above the range of the current escapement goal, information on this will be presented later by Jaron in more detail. Because the department is charged with the duty to conserve and develop Alaska salmon fisheries on the sustained yield principle, it is the responsibility of the department to develop and routinely review escapement goals. During these reviews, which are conducted in accordance with the Alaska Board of Fisheries regulatory cycle, interdivisional review teams are formed that include staff from the Division of Commercial Fisheries and Sport Fish Division to review salmon escapement goals by management area. The purpose of these teams is to determine the appropriate goal type, BEG or SEG, for each salmon stock within the management area with an existing goal based on the quality and quantity of available data. The team then determines the most appropriate method to evaluate the escapement goal ranges and finally estimates escapement goals for each stock and compares these estimates with the current goals, finally developing a recommendation for the directors of commercial and sport fisheries divisions. As I mentioned, the team evaluates the type, quality, and amount of data available. Basically, if sufficient time series of escapement and total return estimates are available, then the data are considered sufficient to attempt to develop a biological escapement goal. If return estimates are not available, then the data will not provide an accurate estimate of spawning biomass that would result in maximum sustained yield, and as a result, are evaluated using other scientific methods to establish a sustainable escapement goal. Methods to use to develop biological escapement goals include spawner recruit analysis, yield per recruit analysis, and a habitat-based model. Methods used to develop sustainable escapement goals include the percentile approach, risk analysis, limnological and habitat-based methods, and smolts per spawner analyses.
Patty?
Yes?
What is our kind of proportionality between being able to establish a biological escapement goal for systems across the state or the sustainable? How are we? Do you have that information? Just a rough comparison of, are most of the systems done on, do we have enough information, biological information, to do the biological, or are we mostly on the other?
Chairman Seaton, the majority of our escapement goals are sustainable escapement goals. Those that are biological escapement goals are usually very important systems where we focus our efforts and our funding and are able to apportion the catch so that we can have a strong run reconstruction relationship. And that allows us to actually have a better understanding of productivity. But for the most part, our goals are sustainable escapement goals and use those following methods that I described.
Okay. And before we go on, could you just explain a little bit more about, you know, a team that gets together for this? You know, how often do they meet, or what's the composition of a team, and how do they put together? Because I think for all of us, you know, the construction of those goals, I mean, it's not taking a dart and throwing it at a board, and it'd be real nice to have a little better feeling of how that's done.
Certainly, Chairman Seaton. I'd be happy to talk about that. That's one of the reasons I brought this up in my presentation today. I don't think people are aware, really, of the amount of time and effort that we spend on developing these goals. When the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Policy was implemented in 2000, one of the directives was for the department to look at all existing escapement goals and make sure that they were documented. So that was the first step. And that actually took quite a long time, especially because of the advance in technology. We had some regions and some areas that just still had historical escapement information written down in notebooks and logbooks, and so it took a while to get everything organized and tabulated and really look back and see what, not only what were the goals, but how did they figure them out. Okay, so that was the first step. The next step was then to spend the following 3 years prior to the regulatory board cycle to go through each of those goals, look through all of the data, and then of course go through the kind of the steps that I mentioned. Decide, number one, what are the quality of the data? do we have the data to try to get a, to determine a BEG, or do we rather have data that would be more appropriate to determine an SEG? And so usually the teams were composed of about 10 people, including both management and research biologists from the Sport Fish Division and Comm Fish Division. We usually had at least two representatives from the Chief Fishery Scientist's Office, biometricians. And basically, the team would meet, I would say, in preparation for the determining the goals, I would say probably seven times. The first time was to just kind of a reconnaissance mission. Everybody brings everything to the table and we see what we've got. Then people hand out assignments and say, okay, this is what you're going to do, this is what you're going to do. And then the researchers and managers work together to look at the data to see if there were any caveats associated with them. Was this a year where there was a flood? Was this a year where there was a strike? Those kinds of things. So we really took a lot of time in what they call scrubbing the data before we even did anything else. Then we turned it over primarily to the higher level research biologists or biometricians to actually perform the analyses. Then we would come back to the table, discuss them with the managers, see if they felt that these were realistic goals, look at how they compared to previous goals and previous escapement levels that we knew were sustainable. And then finally, everybody began writing up the analyses in the report. At that point, then it would elevate to the regional supervisors, and from the regional supervisors, then the recommendations would move on to the director. And the directors would then evaluate these recommendations and approve or disapprove them. To date, I believe everything's been approved.
Thanks. So it sounds like a very good process. Anybody else? Representative Johansson.
Since we're here talking about these teams, when the commissioner was here, I asked about a specific circumstance down around Ketchikan having to do with a personal use fishery in Yes Bay of Sockeye, which is the same bay that's fed by McDonald Lake. I don't expect you to know the details of it, but I haven't had any contact from the department on my question from a month and a half ago, so you might want to make a note of that and ask the commissioner if they have the information that I requested at the first overview. But in that particular instance where you have a personal use fishery in a bay, and at the same time there, I believe it's coho that they're stocking to build a commercial fishery out of that bay, and there seems to be a little bit of confusion between the two different user groups as to the attention Fish and Game gives to one or the other. Is this a point where your teams get together? You mentioned the sport people and the commercial fishing people get together. As far as reaching a policy call from the department on which one they're going to spend more time and attention to, is that where these decisions are discussed with this goal review, escapement goal review?
Ms. Nelson.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, the teams that I mentioned are specifically formed to evaluate and estimate escapement goals. However, I think that as a department, we are trying to work more together as a team among divisions, to especially when it comes to policy decisions. And I will certainly pass on to the commissioner that there is a question that still needs to be answered.
Follow-up, Representative Johansson.
I always tease my friends from the Cook Inlet. They keep fighting over who gets the fish. And this is one little instance where there's a little bit of friction between personal use fishery and the commercial fishery, and there's a lot of misinformation as to how those decisions are made. So if you guys could make a note to pay attention to that particular area in those two fisheries, you might save yourself a lot of heartache from the users and their legislator. Thank you.
Are there any other questions on the goal setting teams? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me in terms of numbers, and maybe help me narrow this down a little bit, are we talking about individual streams that are managed biologically, okay, or on a sustainable escapement? Are we talking about an area? How big an area do we narrow this down to when we start looking at, are we talking about a whole a whole region is managed biologically or sustainable, or just how narrow does this get?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we have a variety of types of goals. And usually it just depends on the type of data that we have and what would be an appropriate unit to measure. In most cases, these are individual streams, individual systems. And there are situations where we do come up with aggregate goals, and usually those are for pink and chum salmon. And those goals are usually district-wide and sometimes management area-wide. But for the most part, at least with sockeye systems are all done individually. Coho salmon are all done individually. But there are times when pink and chum salmon are estimated in aggregate.
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
If I could, can you tell me the number of these units, however large or small, are managed biologically as opposed to sustainably? Is it a proportion, or can you say there are 10 as opposed to 100, or can you, is it 3-1, 5-1, 10-1, or is it 50-50?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it's less than 50-50. It's very difficult for us to have enough information to actually be able to estimate the spawning biomass that would be required to result in maximum sustained yield. In order to have that, you have to have a very, very good estimate of escapement, which in many cases we have, but you also have to have a very, very good estimate of the number of fish from that system that were harvested, anywhere they were harvested. That is the difficult number to get. There are situations where we use genetics, scale pattern analysis, coded wire tags. In situations like that, we are able to get those estimates. But obviously that's very costly and sometimes impossible regardless of how much money you have to estimate that number. So we definitely have substantially less biological escapement goals. However, our sustainable escapement goals are still scientifically based, and they're based on good data. In situations where we do not feel the data are good enough, we don't even create a goal. So our sustainable escapement goals are goals that we believe are, while we aren't necessarily expecting maximum sustained yield, we're clearly expecting sustained yield.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
When a fishery or whatever the unit is managed biologically, do you also keep track of it using sustainable escapement to verify the accuracy? I'm assuming that the biological is more accurate, and maybe that's a bad assumption. And let me get to the question. If one is better than the other, do we do both in some instances to compare, to develop a baseline to make sure that maybe the biological and sustainable are running, you know, true to form, that we're coming up with reasonably the same number so that there's not any terrible discongruency between the two? Or once we decide to manage it biologically, it's managed and there's no way to compare the two to use one or against the other as a baseline, I guess is the point.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, when we establish an escapement goal, we either establish a biological escapement goal or a sustainable escapement goal. The decision as to which type of goal it's going to be is completely based on the data, the available data. If we have enough data to estimate an escapement goal that will likely result in maximum sustained yield, that is the escapement goal that we recommend, and that is the escapement goal that we manage for. If we don't have enough information to determine the spawning level that would result in maximum sustained yield, we at least can determine a spawning level that we know will result in a sustained yield. And a sustained yield that is on average what people are expecting to harvest. So we don't establish two goals at the same time. We just have one or the other, and we manage for the goal that we recommend. But the other thing that I mentioned earlier is not only do we just come up with these goals, we continually review and refine them. And again, that's done on the same cycle as the Board of Fish regulatory cycle, which is a 3-year cycle. So once we establish the goals, almost immediately the team resumes and begins the next 3 years of collecting data to see if there is any new information that would suggest that we could come up with a better goal or a different goal. And usually they remain the same for quite a long time unless something unusual happens. But there are times when we implement additional research projects, we get improved enumeration systems, and so then we can have a better type of information to perhaps even establish a biological escapement goal instead of a sustainable escapement goal. So we're constantly trying to improve the goals as well.
Follow-up, Representative John.
Thank you. How difficult would it be for you to give us a list of the areas that are managed under each of these two systems? Is that a huge task, or could you? Is this something that's just on a list someplace? Can you, just so that we would have an idea of what's managed, how and where?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it would be very easy to give you that list, and I will do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to have that. Thank you.
And Ms. Nelson, just for clarification, so if we have a stream that we have enough data on to do a yield per recruit analysis, that's probably one of the things that takes a long time to get enough data on. If you would have that, then you would use that information instead of doing a spawning habitat or a smolts per spawner analysis once you have more data so that you can actually give that analysis of what that yield per recruit would be. Is that correct?
Chairman Seaton, that is correct. However, we do try to use all the available data. So for instance, if we had enough data to perform a spawner recruit analysis, we would do that. If we also had smolt information and limnology information, we would also run additional analyses to see if they would corroborate what the results would be from a spawner recruit analysis. And if for some reason they were very different, we would start looking at the reasons and dig a little deeper.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks for taking that little detour with us.
Okay, in order to monitor escapement levels to ensure that these escapement goals are achieved, there are numerous ongoing stock assessment projects designed for enumeration and assessment. Enumeration methods include aerial surveys, weirs, counting towers, sonar, and foot surveys. And we also conduct stock assessment research, and some examples include sampling for age, length, and sex, limnological characteristics, genetics, and coded wire tags. And these are just a few pictures of some of the different projects that we have. In the lower right-hand corner is a sonar, it's a picture of a sonar project, and that's a new Didson sonar that we have been using, and I think maybe you might be familiar with that. It's a sonar that you can actually see little fish instead of just blips on a screen. So technology is improving every day, and hopefully then so are our data. In addition to monitoring escapements, the department manages and monitors the commercial harvest. We have many dedicated area managers that work 24/7 during the salmon season fishery, and I believe that this is one of our true strengths as a department and as a division. We do not manage our fisheries from headquarters. We are on the grounds and in the fishing communities. Local fishery managers are given the authority to open and close fisheries to achieve two goals. The overriding goal is conservation to ensure an adequate escapement of spawning stocks, and the secondary goal is an allocation of fish to various user groups based upon management plans that are developed by the Alaska Board of Fisheries. The Board of Fisheries' main role is to conserve and develop the fishery resources of the state. This involves setting seasons, bag limits, methods, and means for the state's subsistence, commercial, sport, guided sport, and personal use fisheries. It also involves setting policy and direction for the management of the state's fishery resources. The board is charged with making allocative decisions, and the department is responsible for management based on those decisions. The Alaska Board of Fisheries develops management plans in an open, public meetings, after considering public testimony and advice from various scientists, advisors, fishermen, and user interest groups. We just concluded a two-week Upper Cook Inlet board meeting, and in case some of you have not had the opportunity to participate in a board meeting, usually they don't take 2 weeks. 2 weeks is about as long as they go. But they usually last at least a week, and there is considerable preparation prior to the meeting. The preparation, as I mentioned, on the escapement goal alone takes up to 3 years. So usually once a board meeting is over, right away we're starting to prepare for the next board meeting, which will be 3 years in the future. During that time period, we work with advisory committees, task force groups, board members, small board committees that are assigned to work on a particular issue for the next 3 years to try to help it move along the process a little better. But we work on these types of issues for a long time with a lot of people and with a lot of public input. And ultimately, our hope is to be able to improve the regulations for us to be able to manage, primarily to reach our escapement goals, and of course follow the management plans that are set for allocative reasons. I just wanted to give you an example of what happened at the Cook Inlet meeting, which will, I think, be a big help in clarifying the intent of the board when it comes to managing for escapement goals. Basically, there was a modification of an existing regulation clarifying for the department that achieving established escapement goals contained within the specific management plans is the primary objective. You can imagine that we are trying to manage for escapement goals for a number of different systems, and at the same time, we're trying to provide fisheries for sport, commercial, subsistence, and personal use user groups. And sometimes the management plans may say something like, you need to open the fishery twice, but you've got to close it three times this week for 48 hours each. Well, depending on the pulse of the run, if that is causing a huge amount of escapement where we're going to go over the goal, this now tells us you're allowed to step outside the management plan and focus primarily and first on achieving the escapement goal. So this is a big help to us because it's very difficult for the commissioner to be able to step outside the plans unless he has clear intent from the board, because in doing so, there are allocative implications. And so this was a big help for us, and I thought I'd just give you one type of an example of things that are done at the level of the Board of Fisheries that do help us to manage for escapement goals.
Representative Johnson.
Could you kind of walk me through the process that would happen to get the information, where it would come from, and specifically Cook Inlet? Where would the decision actually comes from the commissioner, but tell me about the information gathering and where that comes from and where it's headquartered. Is that a decision that's made? What office does that to get the information to the commissioner to make that emergency open or closure? Tell me about the information flow.
Ms. Nelson.
Chairman Seaton, Representative Johnson. I just would like maybe for you to clarify the question for me. Are you talking about in season?
Mm-hmm. Someone's on the ground someplace, and they say, whoops, and they make a phone call, they write a memo, and so walk me through the process by which the information gets to the commissioner, where it comes from, what office, who does it, to make the decision for the commissioner to say open, close.
Through the chair. Representative Johnson, in the case of Cook Inlet, during the season, we obviously have an area manager for sport fish and commercial fisheries, and they work together with their assistant area managers and researchers to get daily estimates of escapement and harvest. That information is used to make regular decisions. And those area managers follow the plans that are in regulation. If there comes a time when the managers feel that there is a need to perhaps step outside the plan, then they have a meeting with the regional supervisor and staff, who would then bring it to the attention to the directors and the commissioner. Again, in the case of Cook Inlet, not only does that happen, the commissioner has weekly meetings throughout the season on the Cook Inlet fishery. And so he gets weekly updates, and the area manager can oftentimes anticipate what he might expect to happen during the upcoming week and can give the commissioner a heads up in saying, you know, escapements look very strong because of the weather and the tides during the openings this week. We believe this will happen or that will happen. And there's a possibility that towards the end of the week, we may need to make some changes to the plan. So we have regular meetings on that. And when things get really tricky, the commissioner's office will have teleconference meetings with the area managers, the regional staff, sometimes every other day, every third day.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Okay, that's the who. Now, where's the where? Where does the area manager, can you geographically, where's the area manager and the regional managers? Can you break that out for me a little bit as to where, what office they come out of? Are they, is it Kenai, Anchorage, Homer? I'm not sure where they actually have them.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the area manager for both sport and Comfish for Cook Inlet is located, they're located in Soldotna. Okay. We have an area office in Soldotna. We have a number of staff on the grounds in Soldotna, and they are walking the beach every day, flying every day. And then we've got the regional supervisor and the regional management coordinator is located in Anchorage. They spend a lot of time in Soldotna or Bristol Bay or Prince William Sound because they're in charge of all those places, for example, in Central Region. But during the height of the season in Cook Inlet, they'll be usually, at least the regional coordinator or the regional supervisor will also be in Soldotna. The commissioner, well,
where is
yeah. He's a busy guy. But then, of course, you know, Jaron and myself, we're located in Juneau. John Hilsinger, our director, is in Anchorage. And we also travel out to the fisheries in the summer. And we spend time at the different fisheries during the peak of the fisheries and usually during the most controversial times. But we do work together on a regular basis with the sport fish at the same levels. And ultimately, once the decision is made, Jeff Fox, our area manager in Soldotna, will write the news release and emergency order. But after that would be after the approval of the commissioner, especially if it was going outside the plan.
And just to clarify, you were talking about Upper Cook Inlet area managers, because we also have Lower Cook Inlet managers on both sport and commercial, which are located in home.
And I'm dealing specifically with this.
Yeah, Upper Cook Inlet. I just wanted to clarify that, right. It wasn't everything in home. No.
If I might.
Representative Johnson.
And you probably know where I'm going with this. I am an Anchorage legislator. An awful lot of my people, my constituents and my fellow legislators' constituents fish in the far Upper Cook Inlet. And I'm sure you're aware of some of the concerns that exist. And I think this particular addition has caused some concern. So I'd encourage you to move your decision-making a little north. That may not affect your decision-making, but it would certainly give some comfort to my constituents and some of my fellow legislators a little further up the inlet than we're talking about. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Nelson, go ahead.
Well, while we believe that we have been relatively successful in conserving and developing Alaska salmon fisheries, we continue to look for ways to improve our management capabilities. Along these lines of research, we look towards the development and validation of methods for determining carrying capacity of salmon stocks, especially sockeye salmon, and methods for stocks with high harvest rates. In this way, we would be able to better determine the effects of over-escapement on stocks with high harvest rates to assess the various hypotheses concerning density dependence in sockeye salmon at various life stages. On the management side, for those fisheries with sufficient fishing power that operate on high productivity stocks, we recommend that better preseason forecasting tools be developed so that managers, processors, and fishermen are aware of impending large runs prior to the initiation of the fishery. We also recommend that adequate tools to assess the in-season strengths of runs be developed so that managers can make timely management decisions to avoid foregone harvest. Good fisheries management and a pristine environment have allowed Alaska salmon populations to make the most of the favorable ocean conditions and to allow users the opportunity to achieve record-level harvests. The continued health of the salmon fishing industry in Alaska depends to some extent on external forces. Alaska is one of the last places in the world with large wild salmon populations, but even with continued scientifically based escapement goal and abundance-based fishery management regimes, and with continued pristine freshwater environments for salmon, reproduction and freshwater rearing, the adult run sizes will be dependent to some extent on oceanographic phenomena that are impossible to control. Also, the price of salmon, and hence the economic health of fishing industry, is driven to some extent by the worldwide supply of farmed salmon originating outside of Alaska. And recently, increased escapes of farmed Atlantic salmon from British Columbia pose a threat in terms of diseases, competition, and possibly genetic mixing with our wild stock fisheries. So we continue to try to improve our research and management because Alaska's economy, culture, and even identity will continue to be shaped by the salmon because of the importance, size, and history of its salmon fishery. That's all I have for you today.
Well, thank you. Very good presentation. Are there additional questions from the committee? Keenan, thank you very much, Ms. Nelson. Sharon? We do have a question. Representative Wilson.
I just have a comment because looking at what happens in Southeast Alaska and look what happens with the Cook Inlet situation right now, I can see that there is going to be again something that happens just because of population, but there's going to be more legislators probably in that area looking at and complaining about the amount of fish that the sports people can get just because of the fact that half the people of the state live in that area, and so you've got your job cut out for you, and I appreciate all the details that you go into and the careful way that you really try to deal with this.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'd like to respond to that. First of all, thank you. And second of all, I think one of the great things about our system is that we have the Alaska Board of Fisheries, and they are the ones charged with making the allocative decisions. Luckily, we just have to worry about the fish. That's our job. So, thank you.
Okay, appreciate that very much, Patty. And Sharon, you? Welcome, and would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jaron Bruce, and I'm an assistant director with the Division of Commercial Fisheries. And the presentation that I am going to be giving, let's see if that didn't seem right. Oh, I'm on the last slide instead of the first slide. That's the problem. The presentation I'm going to be giving is a follow-up to the excellent presentation that my colleague just gave, which I think gives you the understanding of the process that we go through. And one of the things that she mentioned is that we continually are evaluating our program and trying to make it better and seeing if we're successful in achieving our goals. And in fact, when we started developing performance goals for the budget to provide information to the legislature and the general public about the success of our program and the benefits that the public was getting from its investment in commercial fisheries, we chose our escapement goal performance as a measure of that. And it is a significant portion of the work that we try to accomplish is devoted to that. Now, having said that, I'm sure you can all appreciate that there are many things in the in achievement of escapement goals that are, in fact, beyond our control. There are many, many variables, some natural, some economic, some information-based. So we're never going to be perfect, but we strive for perfection. So looking overall at statewide, and this information that I'm presenting to you is a summary of information that is contained in more detail in two reports that you've received earlier, a success in achieving salmon escapement goals in monitored systems, and then also a potential unrealized harvest and ex vessel values report. So, thanks. So, there's more detail in those reports if you want to go to them. Now, looking at this, you can see that we monitor on an annual basis someplace between 300 and 250 stocks. Now, obviously in Alaska, we have literally thousands of different systems that produce salmon that we harvest. There's no way that we can monitor all those systems, so we've carefully chosen systems that are important and systems that serve as indexes for larger production units, and that's what is represented in these number of goals that we're looking at. Now, if you look at this chart, which contains the history or our performance from 2001 to 2007, the blue is the number of stocks that were below our goal on an annual basis. The purple is the ones that are within the goal, and then the yellow is the ones that are above the goal. And then below the graph, you see the tabular data. So you can see that, you know, our number one objective is to at least reach the minimum goal in order to maintain productivity, because if we're going consistently below that goal in the system, we're going to start lose productivity, and that's something we want to avoid. So we do very well in that regard. As you can see, it ranges between a high for these years of 17% and a low of 9%. So now the other issue is going over the top of the goal, and that's what we're going to address some in this report today. So looking now at the different regions, region by region, and there's some significant differences in the regions that that are important to consider, and they have a lot to do with the kind of salmon that predominate the production in those regions, and therefore the kind of management and the kind of information we have to use. And in Southeast Alaska, for example, pink salmon are the dominant species, and so our escapement goals generally there, as Ms. Nelson explained earlier, deal with stocks, groups of stocks that are managed as a unit and not individual stocks, although we do have, in the case of sockeye and coho and chinook salmon, some individual escapement goals for specific systems.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
Chairman, do you give this presentation outside of this building?
I haven't. Haven't recently, no. I don't know if I don't think I have.
I'm just wondering, because the last slide we had a spawned out hook-nosed king salmon, and this one we've got a spawned out humpy. Is that on purpose for escapement? Because it's not the best representation of our wonderful seafood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, yeah, it is on purpose. Okay. And when I get to the value, you'll have a nicer looking salmon.
I've never caught a fish like that before. I don't know how they do it up in the big rivers up north, but
no, that's a spawner.
We put those in crab pots.
Right. So going to the next slide.
That's
is that more what you were looking for?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So what you have here in this two tables are sockeye and pink salmon, which are very important species in Southeast Alaska and contribute significantly to the commercial harvest. And if you look at the two graphs, the bars represent the numbers of fish that were above our escapement goals, the upper range of our escapement goals, and the a red line represents the value that we estimate of the foregone harvest associated with those fish that were in excess to the upper range of our escapement goal. And then below the bars and lines, you have the data presented tabularly. So you can see that that in the case of sockeye salmon, that on some years, We've had foregone harvests of a couple hundred thousand fish and ex vessel values of around $1.2-1.4 million. On other years, it's down more around 50,000 fish and around $400,000. And just to give you a little bit of perspective, in 2007, the value of the sockeye harvest in Southeast Alaska was about $10 million for that species. So that gives you kind of some kind of range of what we're talking about. Then in pink salmon, you can see that we have, because pink salmon are so numerous in Southeast Alaska, and we can harvest 50, 60 million pink salmon in a year here, we have larger numbers. The scale of these graphs that I go through them are not always going to be the same, so you need to pay attention to the scale of the individual graph. And in the case of pink salmon, we have had as many as 5 million pink salmon that were in excess to our escapement goals. And they were had an estimated value of about $1.8 million. And again, to put it in perspective, in 2007, in which we had a harvest in Southeast Alaska of 44 million pink salmon, the ex vessel value of that was $30 million. Here is the central region. And in the central region, you have three major areas within the central region. You have Prince William Sound, you have Cook Inlet, and you have Bristol Bay. In Cook Inlet and Bristol Bay, sockeye are the predominant species. And in Prince William Sound, it's pink salmon. So here you see that we've got between 90 and 100 stocks that we monitor in this region, and we achieve, we don't reach our minimum escapement goals very often. It ranges from 6% to as high as 16% of the time in which we don't reach a minimum goal, and we go over the goal sometimes as much as 55%. And other times as low as 32%.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Johannes.
When you have below minimums, are they consistently, I mean, can you identify the areas that they come from, or are they just generally all over the place?
We can go into the detail, and we can go system by system, and I could lay out a time series for you of which.
I don't want it. I mean, do you guys internally identify, I mean, are there specific spots where we're never reaching that and you know that's happening? I mean, obviously you must try and identify that stuff.
We can identify those through the chair, Representative Johansson. We can identify those areas, and we do, and we bring those to the attention of our managers, or our managers pay special attention to those and try to find out why that is occurring. That's a red flag for us when we're consistently below minimum escapement goals. We try to address that. We'll take it to the board in case we need regulatory action to assist with that. And the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Policy specifically addresses a failure to reach minimum escapement goal. Did I answer your question, Representative Johansson?
Representative Johansson, follow up.
Are there any areas that you've consistently had that problem and haven't found a solution?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, I think we generally find a solution. It may take a while, and it sometimes is painful because it results in reductions in harvest opportunities for folks. But I can't think off the top of my head of any place where over time we have not been able to address an area where we're not reaching our escapement goals. In some cases, you know, the longer-lived species like Chinook salmon and sockeye, it takes a while to get it back on track. We're very vigorous about identifying those and pursuing that. It's a high priority for us.
And I'd like to just draw the committee's attention to the detailed on the success in achieving the salmon escapement goals and monitored systems. That's this report you have in there. And it goes from 2001 through 2007, and it's generically listing whether it's within, above, or below escapement goal for each one of those systems.
That was the previous slide, Mr. Chairman. May I follow up?
Yeah, I mean, here's the detail for those individual things for everybody's knowledge. Yes, Representative Johansson.
So 2001 on the previous slide, and if you want to go back for folks watching, 16%, 02 is 12%, 03 is 8%, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems like anywhere around 10% we're having every year, are those all
different areas that we're having a little bit of a problem with. So we kind of have an ongoing problem constantly with around 10% of the escapement.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson. Yeah, it's you know, there's natural variability in salmon returns, and you're always going to have ups and downs no matter how good a management system you have. And it could be a result of some freshwater event or something in the marine environment. I wouldn't describe it exactly as a problem. It's a feature of salmon productivity that you have that variability, and your management system has to be flexible enough and sensitive enough to identify those and respond to them. And I think our system has demonstrated over time a high level of success in those regards.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
I think you're right. That is strength of the department and their management plan is flexibility. So you wouldn't characterize these percentages as any chronic problem?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, no, I wouldn't. I would say this is just a feature of the variability of natural salmon productivity, and the management system is designed to take it into account and to adjust for it.
So,
Representative Johansson.
Basically, putting out fires every year is basically how it works.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, yeah, it's responding to changes in circumstances, you know, we do occasionally encounter systems that are chronically depressed for some period of time, and we have to take some very dramatic actions to reduce harvest and to try to understand what's affecting the productivity there and restore them. And those are the situations that we go to the board and involve the board and the public very intensely in. And we had in the late 1990s and early 2000s situations like that in a large region of the state, the AYK region. And we had a three-week mega meeting to discuss management of those stocks with the Board of Fisheries, and action plans and a number of things were developed to recover those stocks. And now, 7-8 years down the road, we're seeing the results of that. All the stocks are not as healthy as we would like, but we're back above our minimum escapement goals in just about all those stocks, and we're getting harvests out of some of them. So. We do have, I want to make sure that I'm clear that we do have situations in which we have prolonged, you know, 10 years of lower production. We address those, and eventually those do turn around.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And while we're on this slide, we're back there. I just wanted to point out that one thing that had been a concern is a trend on the bottom line there, the amount percent that was above the escapement goal. And from 2001 through 2006, it was basically on an accelerating basis, where the trend line was that we were having more and more that we were not able to manage within the escapement goals. And I'm pleased to see that this last year we're down to 32% that weren't. And so I'm happy to see that that's being addressed. Could just be statistics, but at least the statistics are going in the right direction. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is there, I'm looking at each of these escapement, the information that you've given us, and I'm just kind of surprised that every single time that it's in the same year, if the percentage is below the minimum, the lowest and the highest all along that, if we look at that, I'll go to that one but it worked out the same in all of them. But for instance, the low was 6% that were below the minimum goal for 2006. Well, that same year, we were above the upper goal by 55%. And I'm just kind of surprised that every single year it corresponds with the numbers of below and above, only they're just the opposite. Is there any correlation for that reason all along there?
To the chair, Representative Wilson, let me make sure I understand your question. So you're saying that when we have a low number below the minimum, we also tend to have a large number above the mid, above the upper goal.
Yeah.
And what's the relationship there? I think what you're seeing is that when we have a large run, a lot of the region is generally productive and there's large salmon runs to a number of systems. That means that the minimum goals are going to be reached in a high percentage of the systems, and we're going to have a lot of fish. And so in a number of systems, we're going to go over the top of the goal, too. It, what you're seeing is an artifice of large runs and small runs. When you have a big run, you know, you get larger escapements in general, which means you go over the upper goals in more systems, and you are above the minimum goals in more systems. And vice versa, if you have a small run, then you're going to see more situations in which you're below your minimum goals, and you're going to see fewer situations in which you're above your upper goals.
Okay.
I think that's what you're seeing there.
Okay. And just follow up.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
I guess I was expecting sometimes that there would be that it would be in different years, but it follows through every time with the same year, with those numbers being the opposite. And you think that there would be more within the goal range, but I guess not, so I can see where you're coming from. So that doesn't mean anything except that they had a big run that year, and so there wasn't as many that were below the minimums.
Okay. Did you, Representative Wilson? Yes, I think that's what it means. So looking at the actual unrealized harvests and the ex-vessel value foregone in the central region, which again includes Prince William Sound, Copper River and Prince William Sound, Bristol Bay, and Cook Inlet, you've got so we've got one for so the first one's for sockeye salmon, and in Prince William Sound and the Copper River, you can see that generally the number of that's kind of hard to read on the screen. You all have copies of it in front of you. It might be easier to follow along there. I apologize for the resolution, but it's just not as I thought it was better than that. So you can see that looking at the numbers of fish on the left vertical axis, that it ranges in Prince William Sound and the Copper River between 50 and 90,000 sockeye that our staff believe we could have harvested above the escapement goals that we weren't able to harvest. And the value varies from 800,000 to 300,000. So when you look at the total number of fish we're taking there, you know, up to 3 million sockeye in 2007, that's pretty, there's not a lot of error, or there's not a lot of lost harvest in that particular region. Bristol Bay is a different situation, kind of the opposite. You can see that during the early part of this period of time that the graph covers, we were very low, virtually none. And then the last 3 years, in which we've had larger returns to Bristol Bay, there's been around 2.5 million fish in 2006 and 2007 that we could have harvested that we didn't harvest, and an ex vessel value of between 8 and 9 million. Again, putting in perspective, Bristol Bay in 2007, we harvested 29, almost 30 million sockeye with an ex-vessel value of $106 million. And those are preliminary ex-vessel values. They generally tend to go up a little bit when we get the final information from processors about what they actually paid. Looking at Cook Inlet, Cook Inlet, as I think the discussion earlier showed, has been a problem area because of the complexity of it, the number of stocks, the number of users, the complexity of the management plans, and other factors. And so you see that you know, we've been losing opportunity to harvest somewhere around 500,000 sockeye in 2004 and 2006, and somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million worth of value. In 2007, that dropped significantly, and as the chairman said, hopefully that's the beginning of a trend. Looking next at pink salmon in Prince William Sound and in Lower Cook Inlet, you can see that in Prince William Sound, really we only have 1 year, 2005, in which there was a significant harvest that we didn't get, and it was a value of about $700,000. And again, given the total size of the return there and the total size of the value I don't think it's a very high percentage of those. Looking at Lower Cook Inlet, you know, it's pretty consistently not harvesting all the pink salmon there that are available to harvest. And the chairman is probably pretty familiar with some of the situation circumstances there that contribute to that. There's some systems that are in remote areas and are, you know, kind of difficult for the fleet to access, and that tends to restrain harvest. But in our view, it's really not a management constraint. Now, looking at the AYK region, this is the area that I mentioned earlier that we were having some problems with back in the late 90s and early 2000, early part of the 21st century. And you can see that below the minimum goal, we were in 2001, 2002, 2003, we were up around 25%, which is a lot higher than you saw typically in the other areas that we've looked at so far. And then, as I said, I think those stocks have started to respond to the rebuilding efforts that we have initiated, and so we're starting to see those minimums drop into the areas that we would expect to be there based on natural variability within the systems. And now, also, unfortunately, in the AYK region is an area of the state that, because of its remoteness, because of the high operating costs, and as a consequence of losing productivity in the 90s, and we lost some of our buyers out there, we've really had a difficult time utilizing those fish commercially because of those economic, primarily economic factors. So you can see that looking at Chinook salmon, you know, in 2004, there was almost $3 million worth of fish that could have been harvested above our escapement goals. And that's quite a concern to us in an area like the AYK, where opportunities to make cash income are limited. So, but that was the only year that was really up there, and you can see that it's actually been declining. Part of that is due to run productivity, and part of it is due to return of markets and being able to get some of those fish into a market in the AYK region. Looking at pink salmon, you know, essentially there is no market for pink salmon in the AYK region. It's not a major pink salmon producing area. Norton Sound produces a lot of pink salmon, and there have been periodic efforts by the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation to try to utilize those pink salmon, and it's been problematic and difficult for them. But you can see that we're, you know, up to five to six million pink salmon in that region, mostly coming from Norton Sound, that are available to harvest and we're not harvesting. And the value of them is you know, as high as $2 million in 2004. Coho salmon, you know, generally very low levels of foregone harvest and lost value there, except for 2003. And then chum salmon, which has been one of the species that is abundant in the AYK region, but one that lost markets and one we're having a hard time getting markets back established for them. There's been significant value foregone there, as much as over $4 million. So again, in a region that could really use that money, that's not something we like to see, and it's really be something that we'd like to see changed. And it is changing. We had a higher harvest of chum salmon in the AYK region in 2007 than we have in a while, and you can see that foregone harvest dropped. But we're still talking about $1 million worth of fish.
And Mr. Bruce, is that mainly market constraints, or is there regulatory constraints on that?
Mr. Chairman, it's primarily market constraints and the high cost of operation in that part of the state. Now, looking at Westward, which is the final region, again, you can see that you know, our range of when we're below the minimum varies from 8% to as high as 22% in 2003. This is a very large area and includes Kodiak, both the north and south side of the Alaska Peninsula, and then also the Aleutian Islands, although salmon production in the Aleutian Islands is very minor. But it's primarily Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula, Chignik. Looking then at the next slide, which is the foregone harvest, looking at sockeye, you can see that in the And these are actually broken out into the sockeye. Sockeye are very important species in the Alaska Peninsula, broken out into the Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak, Chignik, and then we have a pink salmon graph on this same page. So the foregone harvest in the Alaska Peninsula was as high as 500,000 fish in 2004 and 2005, and as low as a little more than 100,000 in 2006. And we've had the values there range from $2 million to about $500,000 in foregone harvest value. Looking at sockeye, salmon, and Kodiak, we had some, you know, really big increase in productivity in Karluk in particular, and Kodiak in the early part of the 21st century, and the run tended to shift early. So we did have to make, that was a situation where we had some changes in productivity, some changes in run timing. We needed to make some adjustments in management to get on those fish. We did, and you can see that that we've been much more successful in harvesting a high percentage of the fish there since that. Then Chignik, you can see Chignik, the Chignik situation is very, a relatively small number of fish that are foregone in excess of escapement goals. And but still, you know, some years there as much as $500,000, and the one year back in 2001, $2.5 million. And I'm not sure whether that was a strike-induced event or just a very large run and processing capacity limitations. I'd have to, sorry, I don't remember the circumstances for that off the top of my head.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
I've just been trying to figure this out, and I haven't figured it out. Battling with myself and my brain, so hopefully someone can enlighten me. When you talk about market conditions and you're talking about value of unrealized value, how do you determine the value of a fishery that has no market? What's your multiplier? Is it based on what used to be? Or, I mean, if there's no market, I'd imagine the value would be zero.
Ms. Bruce.
To the chair, Representative Johansson, that's an excellent question, and it is a somewhat of a hypothetical calculation that we're making. I mean, what we do is we just take the average price paid for the salmon of that species that are harvested in that region of the state and multiply it times the weight of the fish that were not harvested. So it's based on what the value of the fish of that species within that region actually were. And so, in that sense, I think it's a fair comparison, but given the market situation, it's if there's no market, you know, your question is very relevant. I think, you know, does it really have value? It has theoretical value. It has hypothetical value if you could create a market, but there's that big if there. But the way we develop it, the way we estimate it, is simply to take the value of a fish from that region, its price per pound, and the average weight of the fish in that region, and come up with a, and multiply them and come up with a value.
Thank you.
And just for the committee's attention, the reason, you know, we've requested as a committee that information, because in some cases something might be market constrained, in another case it might be regulatorily constrained, and so there could be a value that we're foregoing because of our management regime at the time. And so unless we identify how much value is being foregone, I mean, if it's, you know, it's $1,000, it's different than if it's $5 million, and we might need to pay more attention to see if there's regulatory constraints instead of just market constraints. So that's why I had asked for that valuation to be generated. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm specifically confused on the market value portion. Thank you.
Mr. Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a final slide. You saw this slide earlier in Ms. Nelson's presentation. And just, you know, despite all the natural variation and the factors that limit our ability to harvest 100% of the salmon available and extract all the value from the resource, you can see that we do have a very successful system. We're harvesting very large numbers of salmon. And compared to the whole historic length history of the salmon, commercial salmon fishery in Alaska, the last 20 years have been the best ever. So there is variation. We could do better, given more tools, more control over factors that are frankly outside of our control. But even given all those limitations, I think the state and the citizens get a very good benefit from this resource and from the management of it.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the presentation. Are there questions from the committee? I guess I would just like to follow up that last year we had a follow-up on some major streams where we had foregone value, and we would like to follow up with you on that so that we can look at those major systems that have been historically having that foregone value and see if there's anything that we can do for creating better economics for whatever region that's in, and whether it's a regulatory question that we need to address or whether it's markets. There are things that we've been trying to do, whether it's tax credits for value-added fish, direct marketing to allow, if there's not a large processor, individual fishermen to be able to go out and harvest and get that value for the state. As we all know, that's our, you know, our job, and your job is to get the maximum value for the people of the state from the resource. Really appreciate this analysis, and we'd like to follow up on those specific streams that there's large foregone value over consistently over time to see if there's anything that we or other folks in the legislature or throughout the rest of the industry can work with for getting that value. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the market value, and you know, I'm somewhat of a traditionalist when it comes to economics, and supply and demand drives price. Is there anything in your formula that said if we were to catch that additional number of fish, it might drive the price down? I mean, it seems to me like there's a disconnect between, you know, if you're a purely economic model of supply and demand, more supply would mean lower price. So that I think that there's, I just want to, your opinion is the fallacy, and just because we catch this number, we got this price for them. If we caught that many more, the price might have gone down, and that difference would have, you know, come together more, so that we might not have had that much value had we caught that much fish. So we're really, you know, the lines don't meet. If you catch that many fish, it's going to drop the price. So somewhere, and I'm wondering if there's any anything in your economic formula that allows for the additional million fish or whatever it is that we're figuring in the value we're missing, what that would do to the supply side in dropping the price.
To the chair, Representative Johnson, no, I did not attempt to adjust the value based on some consideration for what the increased harvest might do to the price per pound, for example, of salmon overall. I guess my personal opinion is that when the numbers of fish that we're talking about, even in a place like Bristol Bay, when you're talking about $8 or $9 million worth of fish, and you look statewide at a $200 million sockeye salmon value in 2007, that I don't think that increment is going to turn the dial very much, if at all. And you also got to realize that the Alaska salmon competes in a worldwide market, and farm salmon, which actually is greater in volume than Alaska salmon, has a major role in determining what the prices, and especially the price floor and the price ceilings, are out there. So while it's not a deliberated judgment, my response to you would be that I don't think the amounts we're talking about here would lower the value of other salmon perceptibly, and I did not take that into consideration, not because I thought it wasn't a factor, but I didn't have the expertise and the tools to do that. That fairly complicated, you have to make a lot of assumptions in order to come up with that kind of adjustment. I think it's possible that it might affect it, but I think it's unlikely, I guess, is what.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
And also the discrepancy in prices between regions. I mean, if you take a statewide average, and, you know, we all know the legend of the Copper River King, that's, you know, God knows how much the first first one sells for per pound versus, you know, a Yukon River King or something if you were able to sell it. Is there any regional adjustment in this, or is it just a straight across the board analysis?
Mr. Bruce?
To the chair, Representative Johnson, we actually took the regional prices so that we did account for that. So we took, when we were trying to look at the value in the Copper River, we took the average price for Copper River sockeye salmon. When we were looking at AYK Chinook salmon, we took the price for AYK Chinook salmon. We get that information reported to us on a regional basis. We can't break it down to, you know, specific systems, but we can identify and estimate average price per pounds for sockeye from Southeast to Cook Inlet to Bristol Bay to the AYK region. So we use those regional prices to try to make it as accurate and as possible.
Follow up.
But on the statewide average, what number do you take when you use a, you know, the slide, this one, where it's a statewide average all species? What do you just average all the prices together, or do you take just a little the methodology as to how you get the numbers to see how much money we're not getting?
To the chair, Representative Johnson, what we actually do is we do the calculation for each region. And this is actually on our website. You can see it, and it looks like this. And it's so you have Southeast, the five species listed, what the average price per pound for those species were in the region, what the total weight was, and then what the value of that species was in the region. And then so you get a value by species, by region, and then when we go to the statewide totals, we just add up the sums for each of those regional calculations. So again, we're trying to make the prices reflective of reality and the values reflective of reality by trying to get as much detail as we can.
Did you follow up?
Yeah, I want to try to get a handle. I want to be as accurate as we can because I don't want to miss any value. But there's also a point where if you have, you know, over escapement, and had we caught those fish, we'd have driven the price down, and we really wouldn't have had any additional, we wouldn't really have lost any money, would have just caught more fish, and there's certain biological reasons to not have over escapement, understand. But I don't want to make a direct correlation without all the information, that accurate information, that assumption of dropping price, that we're missing $2 million of value because we let these fish go. We may not be missing that because I don't think the lowering of the price because of the additional product on the market has been considered. I don't know. I understand there's assumptions that you have to make. But also there's the sometimes we've had situations where buyers would sometimes not come in with the price they needed, and there were strikes, and we've seen that happen before, and how much of this is market driven as opposed to, you know, the numbers. You know, there's numbers on a page can say pretty much anything, but I don't think all the considerations are in there. So I don't want to jump to the conclusion that just because we missed X number of fish we lost this much value, because I don't think they correlate directly without adding in the supply and demand and all the other aspects of that. So I want to be cautious about making management decisions based on money we may or may not have lost based upon an economic model that, in my opinion, doesn't take in all of the considerations. So I just want to put that in opinion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
I think that's kind of what I was trying to get at.
It was.
And one of the other considerations, you talked about different regions, you know. And I'm sorry Representative Edgman isn't here, because we've had this discussion for years about chum salmon up there. You know, we've got a lot of harvest in Southeast because of their location and challenges of getting it to market at a reasonable cost. They have lower prices in their area. And as Representative Johnson was talking about, you know, a change in a different region is economically, you know, I'd love to have an economist come and talk to us. Well, not really, Mr. Chairman.
I'll talk to
the economist myself. But I think those are things that we need to be extremely cautious of taking numbers without really delving into the effect on all of the different factors. So I'd echo the comments by Representative Johnson.
And, you know, and I believe you're both correct, but thing works both ways. If you're in the AYK and you have chum salmon that are being sold at a certain amount there, if you don't have enough volume being delivered, you actually can get a lower price than if you have enough to economically sustain a plant more efficiently. So it's one of these things that has multiple remedies, and I would like to point out to the committee in the appendix to the report, the white paper report that we have, it's talking about each individual river system and what the department feels was the constraint on the development. It's in this one that's called Success in Achieving Salmon Escapement Goals. And so I think it'd be for each of us to look through areas where we're concerned about very good information. One other thing that I wanted to ask you just before we go on is that last year we had the report on the projected processing capacity, and there were some what appeared to be big holes, like 650,000 chum salmon in Prince William Sound were identified as not being processing capacity. Can you just get back to us independently, because you don't have the data with you here, on whether we experienced any of those foregone harvests that had been identified pre-season that came through and actually occurred, and what, so we can see if there's anything we can do to identify those ongoing and to address them in any way. Appreciate that.
Mr.
I
kind of want to bring this full circle. I would be very concerned about using lost economic opportunity as a management tool for species because of some of the holes that I see in it, just like I'm concerned with some of the tracking we do on the fish. I would hate for at some point for someone in an office to say, God, we're missing $2 million worth of fish. Let's open the season. Or we're getting too much, let's close the season. I would hate to see that economic loss, potential economic loss, be a decision-making element when I think we should be talking about science and numbers of fish and sustainability. I don't think that needs to be, I understand it's part of your responsibility, but that should be way, way down the list in terms of managing fish stocks based upon an economic model that I have some concerns about existing. So that's kind of my two cents that I'd like to end with. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, could
Mr. Bruce.
Representative Johnson, you're not going to see us, I don't think. I mean, as the chairman said, you know, we prepared this information for the committee at the committee's request, and I think it is valuable information, and certainly the public, you know, has concerns about trying to harvest the fish that are available to them to harvest. It's up to them to bring those issues forward, and that's why we have the board process, and that's what it's designed for, is for them to if they see opportunities in their region that are not currently being realized, they have an opportunity to bring them forward and try to work with the policymakers, the rulemakers, to develop management plans and regulations that will improve the opportunities to take advantage of those resources. And then it's our job as managers to implement that. But it's not really, you don't really find us in the position of coming forward and pushing economic values as far as what the board should do. We will certainly identify places where we're not able to successfully manage within our escapement goals. That is part of our responsibility to make that information available to the board. But I just want to reassure you that that's not the purpose, and that's not where we're going with this presentation. It's informational, and it's really for people like yourselves to decide what to do with it.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
If I could, thank you. And we're going to talk Upper Cook Inlet again. I specifically would hate to see, and just like you said, someone go to the board and make an argument because of lost economic opportunities when we're looking at systems that are dwindling. And we have, and I'm going to talk sports fishing here, we have sports fishermen that can't catch, or their fish are not in the streams. So I would especially hate to see someone come to you in the Cook Inlet and say, gosh, look at this missed opportunity that we have because we're the values. And at that point, I would almost be, if that's the decision-making process, because you did say people come to you and present this opportunity, especially in that area, I would be very concerned about using that as a decision-making process for enacting one of the new policies of an emergency opening or emergency closing in light of areas where we're not getting enough fish back and in lack of the biological data and some of the information until we get a handle on why. So I would be very, very concerned if this type of data was ever used in a decision-making process in the Upper Cook Inlet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for that. And before we go on to 134, I would just like to point out that there is a constitutional obligation of us and the state of Alaska to have the maximum benefit of its resources. That does not necessarily mean only economic benefit. There's the other beneficial uses, sport and all, but all of these factors have to be brought up, and they need to be brought up to the Board of Fisheries that makes those allocation decisions. There is no ability of the department to come in and override the allocation decisions that are made by the Board of Fisheries. The Board of Fisheries establishes those policies. They are the allocation entity within the state of Alaska. I know that some people are disturbed that the Board of Fisheries made a policy that they recognize that the commissioner is charged with having emergency openings to fulfill within those escapement goals, and that's a board policy. And that's that if there's an allocation decision, it's not going to be by, it better not be by the department, it's made by the board through the public process. So anyway, appreciate your presentations here, and we have three people to testify on 134, and we will close testimony. Let's go to Philip Joe.
It's the new lift.
Val Anguson. Val Anguson, you online?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
Chairman
you.
Sweden, committee members.
Yes, we can hear you. Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, and please make it to the version O, the sulfide minerals that we're talking about in this bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Val Anguson. I'm testifying on House Bill 134 and any version thereof. I oppose House Bill 134-O that attempts to change illegal land use patterns in Southwest Alaska that go back to at least to the Land Claims Act, 1970. I'm a graduate student. I have been employed by Pebble in the past. I'm currently representing myself as a resident of the state of Alaska, of Bristol Bay, shareholder of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and the Alaska Peninsula Corporation. I do not represent anyone except myself. My wife is a small wholesaler who is primarily working in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, trying to sell salmon, whose product primarily comes from Icicle Seafood. I'm a former member of the Alaska Board of Fisheries from 1982 to 1989, when Jaron Bruce was still gillnetting in the Southeast. With that, I request the committee not to adopt measures to impede, restrict, or not allow current legal mining developments in southwestern Alaska once a core drilling program is completed to inventory the ore, once the socioeconomic studies are completed, once their production plan is completed, their logistics plan is completed, and other 60-plus permits approved, there will be absolute assurance that the ore deposit at Pebble will be mined and shipped in an environmentally safe manner. I am told that Pebble is aware of the sensitivities and do not intend to go into this venture simply to violate the law and be shut down permanently. The current economic values estimate the ore in 2007 numbers over $300 billion, not including the money multiplier effects for the state of Alaska. Now, with these assurances given, it would appear that it would be poor public policy to restrict current legal land use process in Southwest Alaska and as a shareholder of BB&C APC, who owns subsurface rights to Village Corporation. The land selections in Alaska beginning in 1971 were premised on economic value, which includes minerals. You would, in effect, be rewriting a significant element of the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act of 1971. I urge this committee to regularly consult and communicate with your DNR to be assured that your constituents' concerns are addressed. And Chairman Smeaton and committee members, I want to close by thanking you for giving Alaska and remote areas of the world their opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Val. Is there any questions? Seeing none, let's go to Leslie Ilusik.
Sorry. Could you hear me? This was Lily. Could you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Would you go ahead and say your name for the record?
My name is Wesley Lichik. I live here in the village of Alaknagik. I'm representing myself, but I'm a tribal council president. I'm on a city council. I was a former mayor. I'm on the village corporation board. I was the president for 14 years of that village corporation. I'm strictly against this House Bill 134 because it will, restrict on the village corporation, on private landowners, for any kind of economic development. We have a very high level of unemployment in the village right now. And like I said, this bill is strictly aimed at Pebble, to stop the Pebble project. That's why there is House Bill 134. But I am strictly against it. A couple years ago, it's saying something about, salmon habitat and clean water. A couple years ago, I live here in the village. There's 13 miles away from us, really big, major salmon spawning grounds, like Old Walk River. I was towing up an intruder, aluminum boat, up a Gulwok River with my jet, outboard jet motor. Then the day was really sunny, really hot, so about halfway up. I told my wife to give me, a cup of cold water from the river. She gave it to me. I started drinking the water, but it tastes like gas. So I told her, this cup is gassy. Give me water with another cup. So she did the same thing and tasted the same thing. So I looked up. There's about 20 to 30 John boats, from the largest that were above us. Fishing. All that gassy, all that toxin was going inside the major spawning grounds in the Gulwok River. So I took a cup, from the outboard motor. That water is that running out just like when you turn the faucet full. It was like that. So I took the cup back over there and tasted it. Kind of burned my mouth and my taste. The taste stayed in my mouth all day long. If it does ever pass, they should include all those large boats, not to be in major spawning, salmon spawning grounds. So I'm really in for, if public project goes through, it will be the biggest economic development ever seen in Bristol Bay. We have, as of now, every first of the month, you're going to see, 70 up to 100 families from one village going into store using Quest cards, U.S. government credit cards, buying food. We cannot be letting that happen. These are young men. They're able-bodied young men, but with no jobs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Osley. Any questions? Seeing none. Steve Anguson. Representative Johnson has a question.
Wesley, I appreciate your comments about the outboard motors. Would you be more comfortable with this bill if it basically banned all pollution from the water? If we're gonna take Pebble Mine, would you be more comfortable with it if we were to take all pollution out of that area and return the waters to their natural state?
Yes, I'd be very comfortable, you know, if it include all the water pollution, because all kind of toxin, you know, is coming out from the outboard motor. When there's up to, you know, 50 to 60, you know, sports fishermen in the Gulak River with all the outboard motors running. I mean, the gas, you know, that water. It wasn't like when I was growing up, you know, the water was always drinkable. But now when with that many gun boats, you know, in the Gulak River, I mean, the water doesn't taste right.
Well, I appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Wellesley.
Yeah, thank you.
Steve Angerson. Steve, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Would you go ahead and give your name and who you represent for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
My name is Stephen Angerson. I am calling in representing the Naknek Village Council, who directed me to testify. I do so reluctantly because I am in, also an employee for Pebble. I work as a community associate. But they have directed me at the meeting on Wednesday to testify, so I am going to testify. Naknek Native Village is against HB 134, a bill that would ban sulfide mining in Bristol Bay. I am sure you folks know that there are at least 7 or 8 mines in development in Bristol Bay already. The bill would lead to division in an already divided region. It divides the state. Even if this bill passes, would the mines in development already be exempt? And can the legislature adopt laws that only affect a certain region, like you are doing in this bill? Southwest Alaska Bristol Bay region, I've been on a Bristol Bay Borough Assembly before in the past, and now I'm on the Naknek Village Council. I worked for Bristol Bay Housing Authority for many years. We started the Southwest Alaska Voc Ed Center in here, in King Salmon, to try to get people jobs because of the decline and disaster of the fishery. I know that fishery in the whole state is not keeping up with its past glory. Many years ago, when I was on the Bristol Bay Borough Assembly, we would get at least 3 to 5 million a year from fish tax. And now they only get about 300,000 to 400,000. The fishery is in disaster, and I think this southwest region, Bristol Bay, is in disaster. It's in itself. But, you know, I don't want to argue fish ecology or whatever. This bill here would ban an economic opportunity for our native corporations, which I and my whole family are shareholders of. There are many mineral deposits located on our native lands, and they will be developed. If you take away that right, would you have to pay for it? Pay for an already given right to a mine? Does the legislature do studies on the laws that you pass? Do you do studies on laws, whether they're constitutional or, you know, do you guys just throw out laws in the beginning and then just flush them out throughout the year? And I think these laws should be looked at before they should be given full-blown votes throughout the whole state. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Steve, is there anyone else? Is there any questions? Seeing none, That was the remaining public testimony we had, and so I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 134, and on Monday we will be looking at taking up amendments and committee discussion and committee action on the bill. Anything else to come before the committee?
You're not entertaining a motion on the bill right now?
I'd like to.
No, we will. We have we have amendments before us that need to be offered.
Okay.
So at that, we will be. And thank you, everybody, for your attention and running over here. And we are adjourned at 10:23.